of course, with Sharapnin, with Sharapnin, point hardly worthy of mention, but seeing in silence some stills of objects that are literally vibrating and making extreme and strange noises, and of course a video, is to take away the essential dimensions of that experience. Our token painter of the evening, as it were, Matt Bollinger, with his exhibition, Bed on the Floor. Elizabeth. Some themes, nonetheless, picking up with one or two, maybe, the themes that pick up with Nayland Blake, but I'm sure Nayland Blake would welcome some of the characters, not bearish enough, perhaps, but some of the characters in Bollinger's show might stray into Blake's world. What do you make of Bollinger's world?
I felt that this was the least successful show of the four. Somehow, to me, the elements did not mesh. I mean, he was trying to give you, I think, a romanticized version of the adolescent fantasy of being a bum and, you know, hitchhiking or traveling aimlessly across the country, drinking and smoking and, you know. But, I mean, there were interesting things about the work. I thought it was very interesting. The technique is quite elaborate. It was all cut and pasted and torn pieces of paper that from a distance, the works on paper, they looked like they had just been painted directly, but actually what he did was he painted very loosely on paper, different colored papers, and then he assembled them to make the images. Sometimes, and sometimes the face would kind of dissolve and look like it had been very roughly done, but there would be another moment where he would have a spiral notebook and he would have carefully cut out every spiral and every little line across the page and pasted it on. And so it was an interesting combination of looseness and, you know, preciseness. And the same thing, dichotomy, was set up by the installation of the sculpture, which was supposed to be some cruddy homeless shelter, like cobbled together to sleep overnight, you know, with a tarp over one's head and an overturned shopping cart. And they were actually, everything was beautified, like the dirt had glitter on it, the wire fence was all made out of fabric with little beads, so it looked like metal. The entire shopping cart was made of paper mache, so it was, again, you know, something that was supposed to be rough and tumble was actually incredibly labor intensive. And even the handwriting on the text in the little room was laser cut, but it was all glued on. So, you know, in that was interesting. But somehow, for me, the fact that he needed to have the sculpture, the paintings, and the texts meant that none of them were enough. I mean, I would have rather just seen the paintings and have them be more complex and have more things going on. But they needed to have, you know, a sculpture. Mm-hmm. So, and I just, you know, some of the poetry or the writing was also quite poignant, but to me it didn't, and maybe it was also the space. I mean, that's the least of the four spaces. It's probably the hardest to install in.
Okay, right. Well, that's definitely food for thought there. Let's try to, first of all, I think Hearn and Martha, work out where the emotional territory and the subject matter of this exhibition really lies, and then let's address the problems that Elizabeth raises with the discrepancy between the thematics and the mode of execution. Hearn, what is his world? What is he describing to us?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a kind of post-adolescent nomadic existence of the road trip, kind of, you know, Jack Kerouac or something, taking off. And I was less impressed with that as I looked at it more, and I began to understand how he made those the texts, the written notebooks, and the fact that he had gone through so many levels of inventing a handwriting and then transcribing that through a laser printer and then gluing it down. It became almost, you know, in a time when we have so many people painting abstractly, here's somebody who's totally obsessed with depicting things and how to represent them. And the layering of the different codes that he went through with the, you know, the reproduction of the of those journals became to me almost that the subject was almost about depicting things and a story as a depicted thing. Perhaps I'm over-intellectualizing the thing.
Well, no, I mean the fact that Marvel...
Or perhaps I wasn't that interested in the actual story, but that was...
The collage element... It intrigues me to be using collage when one isn't, it doesn't really bring, I mean, collage usually, one uses collage to destabilize a reading of a subject or else to enrich a subject by bringing a different language visually or a different world referentially to the image. So it therefore, I couldn't personally get a handle. I liked the feel and look of the, I think his handling of space was good, and the figures were a sort of, had a compelling sweetness for me, some of the adolescent figures, but I wasn't quite sure why they needed to be collage. But I'd still like to try to get to, do you feel that there's something about, is there some connection then between Martha, the fracturedness or preciousness of youth and the materials that he's using?
I don't know if I can answer that question directly. I mean, if I can just sort of back up, this feels like student work to me, and I teach in an art school now, so that is a very empty thing to say sometimes when you say, oh, it feels like student work, you know, but I do, you know, 3 hours of crits every week and did them yesterday. And I really, you start to have a little bit understanding of when something's resolved and when something's not. What I did notice when we were just looking at this, and this is one of these phenomena that many people have pointed out, is the work looks better in reproduction than it does in person. It looks much more... resolved, I guess you would say. The other thing is, my favorite room was the room with the text pieces. I mean, I'm sort of a sucker for that because I am a writer, and I also, you know, I mean, you know, hardcore. I went to an MFA program in fiction. I really like writing, but I didn't think the poetry was very good. And you know, across the street right now at the new museum, there's that 1993 show with the grid of Sean Landers writing on. Yellow legal paper, which, you know, those are really kind of captivating texts, some of those, whereas trying to stand in front of these, okay, it's different. It's a painting. He's sort of reproducing the same idea of legal pads with writing on them, but I sort of just didn't, it didn't really do anything for me in terms of the text. There were a couple of lines that were sort of interesting, but for the most part, it's bad writing and it's not great painting, and so it's kind of harsh, but I completely agree with Elizabeth that it's the weakest show. You want a little bit more why, I don't know, you know, why does it need to be collage? The whole thing, there's a lot of sort of... the other thing that's interesting is that I think the work, and it's true about that space, but if he'd reversed it and at least put the text pieces up front, maybe I would have sort of been drawn in. Instead, the whole thing seemed like a sort of like kind of... I don't know, sort of provisional in the adolescence of the work and the what it was, I guess, sort of discussing. I mean, a kind of like homeless adolescent is a, I don't know, it just didn't really make much sense to me. Oh, and I want to say that the other thing is, I mean, we've seen so much of this sort of like painstakingly fabricated papier-mâché stuff, you know, of which someone like Valerie Haggerty is kind of the... sort of young master of that. This, you know, I just said, okay, so there you go, some more paper mache. But sorry, that doesn't sound very nice. But I knew I was going to not be very nice about this show. So,
well, that's you know, it's the world and the artists need to hear it if people aren't getting the work yet. I would stick by my feeling that there's some positive energy in here. I guess I'm playing a little bit the angel's advocate because of the somebody has to stick up for a show on a panel, otherwise the panel gets boring. The truth is, however, I have problems too with this show. And I was hoping someone would really love it and I could tease them out on it.
Do you want me to say something more positive?
Yeah, go on. Go on. Be the straw man, please.
Well, I just felt, looking at I was suspicious of the amount of craft involved in it. I'm saying, was this just good? Could I see these as a cover of The New Yorker, you know, or something? But but I really feel like he does have kind of it's more of a filmic imagination. And,
yes.
And you know, in movies you see, you know, text journals shown and things like that, and the way he would choose light sources, like the computer, you know, being the light source, or that light on the end of the woman's cigarette, things like that. They were not the obvious sort of things. You know, it took some visual imagination to do that, and so I felt, I would not trash the show. I would think.
No. I feel that he has a real subject one, and he has a visual imagination. I feel the facture isn't coming to meet those.
What's the subject, though?
The subject is alienated youth in suburban America. It's a profoundly original subject. I don't think anyone's dealt with that one yet. So let's give it for a hand for Matt Bollinger on that front. No, when I saw, there's a show that David Humphrey curated in the same space. And by the way, I would take issue with the notion of the space being in any way problematic because that gallery's been the site of some magnificent exhibitions, including two of Marc de Grandchamp, one of the leading European figurative painters right now. And also, it used to be Joel Shapiro's studio, and he produced most of his great early work in that very space. So that's not, I'm afraid Mr. Bollinger can't blame the space, and nor should we. But the subject, yeah, well, it just doesn't really... I have seen a show in that space curated by David Humphrey that first introduced the work of Bollinger in a group show with richer themes bouncing around. In that work, a huge drawing of Bollinger's of a Boy Scout really had a kind of iconic and commanding presence, which made me very excited to see that he was being given his
earlier work, he was dealing more with the high school level, and now he's moved
right
up to...
Yes, maybe he should stay with high school, because...
One thought I had looking at that was thinking of the work of Catherine Murphy, who has also made incredible paintings things drawn on bathroom mirrors and stuff like that, and there's a kind of autobiographical sometime connection among her works, too, and so... But that might be a different level.
Bollinger, tortured adolescent is a very familiar territory. But I got particularly uncomfortable with the show is precisely because when you go to Murphy showing down the road, or if you go to Josephine Halverson obsessing about the overlooked and constructing sort of incredible portraits of... sort of weird and tacky things out there that have their, without being surrealist, but just actually finding, exploiting, obsessing over, and bringing into a compelling realist world the oddities of life out in the burbs or the boroughs. Then I feel that maybe he's in familiar territory or very big, strange territory where some real command of means is required.
Well, if I can just break in one second,
yes.
The problem also, I saw Rochelle Feinstein's show right after that, and so then you sort of have that feeling of kind of going and like, oh, okay, well, this is, you know, because you said oddness. That was sort of like, for me, genuine oddness. This just doesn't feel very odd to me, you know? But, and I am from, I don't know where he's from, but, you know, I sort of know what he's getting at. I'm from the Midwest. There's plenty of, you know, existential angst and, you know, the heartland and all that kind of thing. The other thing is, though, that also the painters that he would sort of tend to remind me of is also someone like Brian Alfred, who is very strongly tied. One of his people that he was sort of obsessed with is like Alex Katz. So I can kind of, it's not that I'm not familiar with this sort of, you know, vocabulary just on a formal level that he's going for. It just doesn't seem to sort of get there, you know, in terms of...
I don't really think also the technique and the subject matter, they don't mesh. I mean, if we're going to do about drug-ridden, you know, miserable adolescence, let's go with Larry Clark. I mean, that really hits it, you know.
Well, yeah, and yes, Elizabeth, you know, Rembrandt can paint the crucifixion. So, I mean, I think, you know, there can be great beauty.
I just felt that there was something contrived about the whole, you know, the whole thing, that it would be better if he would put all his eggs into those drawings and really get more into each one.
Okay.
So it would be a complete world in itself and not need these, you know, texts and sculpture.
I think Mr. Bollinger might have got the message. Good. Let's let's proceed to our last show. And Hearn, as you sat on that subway seat, did the earth move for you?
It did jiggle around a good bit, yeah. Yeah, I was interested in that show and had a little trouble putting the whole thing together, but I was attracted to some of the pieces individually. I thought maybe the most successful part were the big metal forms that seemed to have a dialogue among themselves, and there was a little rhythm that got going and they would interact. And then in total contrast to that was the box with the hologram inside of it that was super high tech and emitted a very different kind of sound. So I kind of experienced this as a series of different things, and you know, it was intriguing. But I don't know if there's the whole thing with the Pied Piper and his video and his personal identity getting involved. I didn't respond to that as much.
Yeah, that added an interesting note, didn't it? Because we were otherwise in a territory of again, to some as familiar as tortured adolescence in the Midwest, but we're in the territory of noise as music, noise as the element within the culture, and then we get a sort of a cross-dressing artist sort of sauntering around an aqueduct in the middle of Rio de Janeiro.
São Paulo.
No, it was Rio, because I said that and I got corrected.
Oh,
no, it's Rio.
No, I was there at Christmas, so I...
remember that aqueduct?
Very well. I was with some Chinese ladies who were suffering from food poisoning and had to be rushed home, but I did get to see the aqueduct nonetheless. Nonetheless, both cities are used to cross-dressers, but maybe in sound art exhibitions in Chelsea, we're not, now that the... we've just got so used to bears that we just don't know what to do with cross-dressers.
I always know what to do with cross-dressers.
We'll discuss what that is later. But if you could tell us, what did you make of Sergei Sharapnin's ear tone box?
I loved it. I looked at the video and I really enjoyed the way he had himself dressed up in fishnets and the little girl dress and the headdress, and he was just walking around this, you know, there was no camp, he happened to have this on, and he was investigating this really spectacular aqueduct and picking up a little piece of this and seeing what it sounded like and rubbing it against a grate, and then some guy comes along and takes his shirt off and puts on another shirt. And I liked the video very much. And I just thought that the whole show was wonderfully nonchalant. And I liked the way he brought the outside world in. I mean, to just go into a gallery and be confronted with a subway bench, that's unusual. And the way he made the objects come alive by giving them voices, and they were all talking to each other and crisscrossing the room. I liked that. I liked the idea of sticking your head in the box and also becoming a musical instrument. Basically, I thought it was great.
Great. Well, there was strange noises going off in that exhibition, and there's now strange noises going off in this review panel. So life is beginning to imitate art, which is just the way we like things. Martha, make sense of the show for me.
Well, I this was my favorite show. I loved it, most of it. I have to say the video, I don't know. But sort of going back to what the gentleman was asking or saying, I mean, in the early days when I first started writing about art, I didn't used to talk to the people at the gallery very much because I was concerned that it would, you know, sort of taint my opinions. Now I don't care because they can try and convince me of anything, and I'm still going to say what I'm going to say. So I was thinking this when we were talking about the Nalen Blake, that the guy working in the gallery actually said that I asked the most questions of you guys. So, and I really drilled down on this one. I've actually seen Sergei Cherepnin play live a few times, so I'm familiar with his performances. I believe this is his first show of works, and I was like a little concerned about how he was going to sort of resolve this in terms of objects and space and sound. But I thought it was great. And it's also sort of coming at an important moment. The, you know, MoMA's going to do their first sound show in a few months, and apparently that bench is going to be in the MoMA show. So, the guy Jacob at the gallery was telling me that how that he had to get it from the MTA, that bench. They had to somehow convince them, well, the bench will be at MoMA, so if you'll give us this bench. But, you know, it brought together a lot of things that I like. I do also have a background in music, so I'm a little bit I'm very critical of that. This is somebody who's, you know, whatever, fourth generation composer or something, and is, I don't know, his grandfather worked with,
Diaghilev.
I mean, it's, you know, one of these kind of people. So there's
so
a lot of...
He can make as much noise as he likes.
Though. Well, but there's a lot of pressure on the composition side as well. But I thought it was really pleasurable just to stand in the space and hear what he did with sound. The other thing, just from a personal standpoint, on the press release, it's talking about compression and MP3s. The world of sound, in the same way we had this sort of performance thing, we're now having this like sound renaissance. I had just read this really fantastic book by a scholar named Jonathan Stern called MP3, History of a Format. And so the sort of like the way that this all came together with like a pretty good show in terms of, you know, the sound and the way, you know, you can sit on the sound, you can feel the sound, you can stick your head in the box and hear the sound, but it's also these intervals, so at one point it's coming out of the mirrors. I just thought it was a good show in terms of objects and composition, and the Pied Piper thing with the video was interesting on, you know, some level, but that was probably the weakest thing for me.
Okay, right. Well, verdict I'm getting from you, Martha, but not to press you on it immediately. I want to try to understand what it means. I mean, I had fun. I liked being on the bench. Taken back to Rio as well by the video. I love Cage and Feldman, and anybody who wants to do anything odd with sound, just let me know, I'll be there. But I still, when I see an art exhibition, I want a little bit more than fun, or sympathy, or to be able to pat someone on the back and say, yeah, this seems cool. I mean, I feel it needs to mean something, it needs to change my life, and I don't know what it means. Hearn, do you know what it means?
Well, I think the theme was sort of this the integration of the sound into the to everyday life and to ourselves and to our bodies, and that this sort of dispersion of the idea from the concert hall where we normally experience music to a more environmental context, and certainly the way the whole room becomes a box at some points with the noise that. I could see the whole thing, and then the Pied Piper idea being, you know, the way it kind of ingratiates itself into the body, so we physically experience these things. That I could see a theme that united these different things. I do feel like in a way it was, I did have a little trouble, you know, seeing them as a total, you know, as I said, I experienced kind of different aspects of sound that I experienced in different, you know, through the different installations. But
well, you can correct me if this has changed, but I think of you as a painting person, you know?
Oh, I think of myself as a uomo universale, I do like painting, but I like sound art.
I think the thing is, though,
and I like music. To correct that,
yeah.
I do like music, and I do like experimental music. But I've written a lot about sculpture, and so I don't feel of course I don't get Sergei Cherepnin's work because I'm, you know, as Martha says, that painting person. No, I don't buy that. But
well, I mean, you just don't get a whole lot of sound in Chelsea. I mean, they're sort of isolated instances. And again, going back to say that 1993 show, you know, and there's the Kristen Oppenheim work in there, you get very little of this. And so I think, you know, the whole point is we are in this thing, what in terms of what it means, I don't know, that's a tricky thing. But the thing is, in terms of the experience it creates, is it reminds you that you have a different sense other than just sort of looking, and that it activates the space in a very different way than, you know, for instance, the Sylvie Fleury, which, you know, is sort of activated through color, you know. So that's the thing for me, is that it is a kind of sound coloration of the space. And, you know, when I sat on that bench, I thought, gosh, I can't really remember too many works like this. You know, there's the Laurie Anderson one where there's the box and you put your elbows on the box, and then when you do this, you hear the sound through your arm bones.
Right.
I don't recall a whole lot of experiences of, you know, sitting on a bench and the sound vibrating up through my body. So it's a completely different experience, and I think part of what I enjoyed about it is that it sort of took me out of, you know, thinking of art in terms of, you know, purely sort of visual.
Well, we get a lot of sound in video installation, and there's a tremendous amount of video in Chelsea. In fact, on the last panel, we reviewed Knutsen, a Scandinavian name, and Icelandic name. That's not in Scandinavia anymore. The rock musicians in that nice house in upstate New York whatever. Okay, shout out the name, someone.
You want me to look it up on the computer?
Yes. Yes. Okay, that'll do. Thank you. So we get plenty of sound.
There's a huge difference, though, sound and video. Usually the space is dark. With video, there tends to be some narrative or some, you know, attempt to thwart narrative. I'm going to point out Lauren because she's a sound person.
Yes.
And it's just a different thing at work. So for me, that was exciting.
Yeah, I think video is much more passive also.
Okay. So if suddenly painting was banned for 100 years, and we came back nonetheless, and somebody lifted the ban, and we'd had 100 years of going to Chelsea and going to great sound exhibitions, and somebody broke the sound barrier, and did a show where there was paint, and he'd put some paint. Would we look at it and say, well, it's just so refreshing to see paint? Or would we say, are these paintings any good? What's he painting? Why is he painting it? How's he painting it? You know, it seems to be very odd sort of level of critical discourse to say that because we don't hear much sound, it's great just to hear some sound, and bravo for sound. I mean, okay, so you're using sound, but do something. What's he doing with it?
What is he doing with the sound?
What?
I would say that he's sculpting with sound, and he makes that pretty explicit by putting it inside a box, but you've got sound coming from at least six different sources. You know, you've got mirrors. So you've got a sort of like alternating, what makes it different than, new music or sort of experimental music is that it does involve, you know, a sculptural element, but it has the same, I mean, it is composed. If you listen to it carefully, you can tell, you know, I walked in and I thought it was kind of like psychoacoustic. No, it's not. It's actually from a synthesizer. But that's sort of part of, I mean, it's a kind of overlapping discourse in a sense. I mean, it's very close to composition. It just happens to be sculptural as well. So it means to me through being sculpture, being in a space, having a relationship between objects, something that you're seeing visually, a cube, obviously, we've talked about the sort of art historical references in all the other work. I mean, there's a pretty, but there are a lot of found objects here too. Yes. Those rain things, there's these kind of rusty things and then sound coming out from under them.
I guess what I'm simply saying is I'm totally open and enthusiastic about the idea of sculpting with sound. I just want to know what he was sculpting with sound. It just needs to go forward. I mean, if he said he was sculpting with metal, we all seen so much sculpture with metal. You don't really want to say, well, what's he sculpting with metal, and does it work, and why did I like the way it worked? You can't say, oh, we just don't see enough metal. You would say, no, it works because of this formal relationship, and that moves on to that. That's what I'm saying.
Well, what about John Cage? I mean, you could hear a John Cage piece. What is that about? How would you do?
No, you wouldn't say what it's about. You would say the piece was compelling, and the middle section did this, and then da da da. Or you'd say, oh, it was just weird that it was all over and flat, and it didn't do anything. But you would analyze it in formal terms.
But this is very much. I feel like we're doing that, and you're saying we're not doing it. This is very much in the Cagean sort of tradition of there being space and there being sound and there being intervals. And using, things. I mean, he doesn't use accident. He's not sort of in that. But it's it's a very strong kind of post-minimalism with sound.
Yeah, and he uses natural sounds. And he, like the gallery was telling me that, Janice was telling me that they are, that you could hear the gallery phone ringing and just various things that he transforms with the synthesizer. And... it had a very quiet beginning, and then it got louder and louder.
Yeah, something got pretty loud at one point with the box. Absolutely.
And then you could put your box, my head in the box, and I took my head out of the box when it was the loudest point, and I really felt like the music was continuing to come out of my head.
Right. Yeah, I must say I really love the subway seat. I mean, we do too much work with our eyes, and to have an aesthetic experience with your posterior is actually. I guess I could say that the subway seat brought out the inner bear in me. So let's hear from our audience. And if I would just say that if you have comments on Matt Bollinger, they should be positive and challenge the and challenge the panel. I don't think at this point need more. Critical critique of Bollinger, but happy to hear on either show.
So you guys brought up the uncanny in the Salon 94 show, and I wanted to know exactly what you meant by the uncanny. Did you mean that the symbols were so, you were so used to seeing them that it was uncanny to see them all in one place? Because I thought this last show that we were talking about had a sense of the uncanny, of this sort of repetition, but you were sort of disoriented, you were sort of lost, and it had a Decherico sort of feel with these, when he was wandering through the columns.
Oh, definitely. And
then, you guys really never touched on, or maybe you did, but the sort of theatricality of you sitting on the subway bench and watching other people experience, the show, which is something you never really do. Usually you're looking at a painting, when somebody comes, you move. So can you guys, address that, perhaps?
Yeah, what do we really mean by the uncanny? And is there not an element of the uncanny in those sort of Decherico moments in the video, in Shurepnin, or in the exhibition at large?
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, just in the simplest sense, that the uncanny is the familiar made unfamiliar. The Sylvie Fleury wasn't uncanny enough for me, I mean, at all. I didn't think it was very uncanny. And you mentioned, what's his name, Robert Gober. I mean, that's the sort of, stereotypical at this point. You know, he's the kind of like paradigm for the uncanny in the early 90s, or, you know, what's her name? Sorry, I'm saying that. I'm a little overextended. Kiki Smith. But I agree with you that this had an uncanniness just because seeing the subway bench removed from somewhere. I mean, I have a lot of associations with those subway benches that, you know, that a lot of times there's some kind of mess you need to avoid or something like that. So I completely agree with you on that, that there was a sort of uncanniness with it. So
I disagree. I didn't think it was uncanny at all. I thought it was very intimate and cozy.
The Chorepnin.
Yes.
Yes. Right. But I think the uncanny in Sylvia Fleury
was not
profoundly uncanny. It's just that the huge razor blade sort of recalled the outsized utensils that it's in a Magritte painting, the title of which I do not recall, but it's you have a cramped, claustrophobic domestic room and then these humongous shaving brush and comb and bar of soap or something. That's all. Yeah. Further comments, audience? Kate?
Okay, I'm going to defend this Matt guy.
Excellent.
I went and saw a show, and I was really intrigued, actually. I saw these collage pastel things as classical, like a classical space in a younger generation, younger than me, maybe a disillusioned generation, but I didn't even look at the subject matter. That would be, for me, looking at, like, Gober, subject matter as what he's painting. So I saw this space, almost like Jasper John's space, maybe, and a new generation approaching flatness. And I was intrigued by these, like, deteriorating frescoes, almost. The paper seemed to me to be a reference to flatness, and not in an incidental way, but in a young mind, a person maybe not who knows themselves yet. And then going around the corner into this room with these writings, you know, it felt like an antechamber, like a place where you would find yourself, maybe, you know, and maybe I couldn't enter into that work, you know, but it felt intimate. There felt a very flat, whispery space in there to me. And you know, maybe I'm influenced a little bit by, I'm reading The Great Gatsby. I was reading it because it was on the radio. And in that work, there's a lot of disillusionment, but there's a whispery air in a classical space. And it's a very thin, poetic, but flatness. And I felt it in the pastel qualities in the work. And I didn't see any of the, I didn't really believe or see the milieu of the grunginess, as you were saying, that really hit Elizabeth hard. You know, I didn't even notice it. So that's how I took the beginning of a voice. I felt it hit me. It actually hit me, that show did. So,
fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. And it's great to have sometimes a fifth wheel in the audience that can provide the positive element to go with the harsher critique that emerges from the desk. Great. Yes, sir.
The sound piece. I don't think it might be a mistake to look for the meaning of it. And I'm speaking only, though, as a non-professional. For me, it was a matter of intensification of sound. And I discovered that the sound was worth listening very carefully to. And when you listen very carefully, you would hear a plaintive sound sometimes. Sometimes it's very dramatic. Sometimes it's playful. It's just extremely complicated. And it intensifies your sense of sound. And actually, it transforms you a little bit when you leave the space because you hear differently. So that's what I found to be wonderful about the piece. And with regard to the Bollinger, I felt touched by his adolescent angst, and I felt something universal in it. I was quite, and I came from this Sylvie show, which I found oppressive, too much like the pathology we suffer in life. And I walked into this show and I felt like, well, this is somebody who's making a gesture in another way, and I felt moved by it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll just say, while someone's raising their hand, the other show downtown that I saw after seeing these was this one, Martin Roth, at Lewis B. James, and there are all these birds in cages in the basement. So it's an interesting, you know, alongside this very sort of, you know, composed cultural sound. I first walked down, and it's, you know, it's on Orchard Street. But I walked down there and I said, oh, it's a pet store. And then I ended up staying for like a really long time. And then I went back upstairs and I said, wow, you must be really relaxed. And he said, I'm so relaxed. And then there's a live feed of it that you can hear through the computer. And then in other galleries, people were listening to it. So it's a sort of a sound moment. And it's also a really nice, I mean, I can show you afterwards if you want it. I have the press release here. But it's sort of interesting, these like bird sounds and then... up in Chelsea, the much more composed sounds. But I think, you know, maybe also with the Matt Bollinger, I saw these other two shows, and it's, you know, sometimes that's what happens, is you see something alongside.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Is there a last comment from the audience? Otherwise, actually, what Martha just did is what we did at the last panel, which was... a moment to be able to shout out for another show, and Martin.
That's my show, Martin Roth
at Lewis B. James. It's the shout out show that Martha Schwendener adds to the roster that we've discussed here at the panel. Without warning, impose it on my other co-panelists, but. Hearn, visiting from California, is a show that's really struck you. You're allowed to mention your wife's, if you like.
I don't know. I it's funny, in terms of sound, I'd been at the Mary Lucier show at Lennon Weinberg before I went over to the sound show, and I was interested in her. The sort of endless thing, she loops around and around and around. You can sit there forever listening to this For Your Precious Love thing going on and on. But it was fascinating. And
yes, I love that show too. At Lennon Weinberg, I told her she's the thinking man's Bill Viola. Elizabeth Clay, is there a show that you'll single out as a must-see show that we haven't discussed?
Only 2 days left. Thomas Lanigan Schmidt at PS1 is really sublime.
Fantastic. Well, once you've crossed the river, make your way up to Williamsburg and make sure you see Sarah Walker at Pierogi. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. See you in June.